seeming to tell me that one of our prevention tools for COVID-19 came from poo?
That's correct.
Kia ora whānau. My name is Tabby and I'm one of the producers of PhD Unpacked, so obviously not James, and this is obviously also not the studio. To end off season 3, we wanted to do something special for you, so we've actually worked in collaboration with our good friends at the Institute of Environmental Science and Research, also known as ESR, and MB, the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment, to talk about poo and how it actually saved a lot of us from the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, James couldn't actually make it for this interview, unfortunately. He's off starring in a show or doing something incredible or impressive like that. So I'm here talking to Dr. Joanne Hewitt, science leader in the Enteric Environmental and Food Virology team. And like you, I have no idea what some read all of those words mean. So in typical PhD Unpacked fashion, we're here to make it more accessible for every single person to understand. Joanne, thank you for being here today. This is completely outside of my world. And as a producer, I may only be here once. So I want to do something spicy, I want to do something fun. I've got a clipboard because I'm not as good as James. But also, I want to start off with a different question. What is your ideal Saturday?
Well, difficult one. I'm not all that good at relaxing.
Yeah.
So I like to keep busy. I like to fit in a little bit of work, but my ideal Saturday would be when I didn't do any work at all and didn't try to think about my work. Good breakfast, nice cafe, bike ride, movie, and probably another movie in the evening, and try not to think about work too much.
Do you have a favourite cafe that you want to shout out and give some credits
Ramati
today?
Ramati Social Club.
Oh, beautiful.
In Ramati South is our local.
Yeah.
Great coffee.
Wonderful. So, everybody at home, keep track with me. So you have a Bachelor's of Science in Biology and Chemistry, a Master's in Biomedical Science and Virology.
Yes.
And a PhD in Biological Sciences from the University of Auckland, my old stomping ground. So that is all correct?
Yes, that's correct.
But I want to take you back to young Joanne. Where did the initial interest in science actually start? How did it come about?
Well, when I was young, I wanted to be a nurse.
Mm.
Then I wanted to be a doctor.
Mm.
And then I wanted to work in a laboratory.
Was there anything in particular that caused those shifts?
Yeah, so I've always been interested in human diseases.
Yeah.
Really interested in medicine, being a nurse, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So at school, I had an option of doing biology, which would have been the natural choice because that's what I was interested in, but it was all girls. And there was a lad I fancied in physics, and I chose physics instead of biology, which meant I had to do some more study for biology later on as a consequence.
Hey, the things we do for love, right?
So that sort of started off my interest really in my career path, really, in what I was going to do.
So when you were talking about how you wanted to work in a lab, I wondered, were you exposed to kind of labs or lab work when you were younger? Because when you said that, the only thing that popped into my mind is there was a TV show called Dexter's Laboratory on Cartoon Network. I don't know if anybody else here has heard of that show. I'm hearing some nods. Great. Was there any piece of media that you saw about lab work or anything? How did that kind of come about?
I'm not sure. I had a friend whose father worked in the laboratory.
Yeah.
And I think that was probably my first introduction that there was such a thing as a hospital laboratory.
Because we know about hospitals, but a lab is something that unless you maybe are exposed to it, you wouldn't have any idea. So that's why I was just wondering. Yeah.
So that was where that developed from. Just just finding out that was a thing.
Yeah. Okay.
I didn't know it was a thing before.
So you did most of your studies, I think, in England, and then you moved to New Zealand to do your PhD? How did that move actually? Yeah,
no,
tell me about that.
Not at all. So I did my degree in Nottingham.
Yeah.
I started working in a laboratory, in a hospital laboratory. Started off in microbiology, where you're growing bacteria.
Okay.
And I did that for a year. It was all too smelly. And I didn't enjoy it. And I moved into a virology laboratory. Everything seemed a bit cleaner and less smelly. Everything was in a biological safety cabinet.
Yeah.
And the staff were a lot better. The boss was a lot nicer. and gave me the opportunity later on to do a master's while I was working.
Yeah.
We moved to another city and I worked in a cancer research laboratory, again on viruses, but it was a different sort of virology.
Yeah.
Came on holiday to New Zealand, really loved New Zealand, fell in love with it. Felt it was home.
Absolutely.
And moved out as quick as I could.
Yeah.
And I was looking for a job. I drove past this building and I said to my husband at the time, that's where I want to work. And within 2 months, the vacancy came up.
Oh, the manifestation.
And I've been here ever since. So I've been here for 26 years, longer than I thought I would.
Yeah.
But it's actually been great.
So the show is aptly titled PhD Unpacked. So I feel as though I'd be a fool to not ask specifically about your experience of your PhD. Yeah. How was your experience of completing your PhD?
Yeah. So I came to ESR as a senior technician.
Yeah.
And just got more and more interested in the subject and felt I was doing research that could support a PhD. So after almost 10 years of being here, I started to do a PhD part-time while still working full-time. So I had a full-time job, registered to do a PhD at Auckland University, and got supervised by a professor at the university, Gillian Lewis, and supervised by my boss here. It took me 9 years.
Oh, of course, because you were doing it part-time.
So I did that while working on projects that would support the PhD. So it's quite a varied PhD.
Yeah, that would have, I imagine having all those different balls to juggle would have been quite a stressful period within your time from probably the other experience. So my mum, she has a PhD and we were living in England at the time. And I remember late nights on trains, 9 p.m. going home in England and just the kind of chaotic nature of working full-time and then having a PhD part-time. So I could imagine it would have stressful time. Glad it's in the rearview mirror.
When I finished, I forgot what I used to do in the evenings. So it was worth it. And it wasn't full on all the time.
It was
towards the end.
Okay, cool.
It was more intense, but
So to a mere mortal such as myself, COVID-19, the pandemic, was the first time that I was kind of exposed to the idea of wastewater testing. I'm not even sure I would have ever heard of it beforehand. Could you take us through a bit of a history of wastewater testing? Has this been, this obviously was not the first time that we used the technology, but could you just take me through what that actually looked like?
Wastewater testing for viruses, that's a part of environmental virology. So environmental virology has been around the concept almost for 100 years.
Oh, wow.
So we're going back to that in the 1930s
when
the idea that diseases might get shed into wastewater.
If you
think about polio, how you get infected with polio, one of the ways is drinking water, contaminated drinking water.
Yeah.
And it took a while for people to realise that was the one of the routes of transmission. So environmental virology started back in the 1930s before all molecular techniques and even cell culture that's used for isolation of viruses. But by the end of the 1930s, they successfully isolated polio from an environmental wastewater sample. And then it sort of slowly developed in the 1940s, cell culture, where you take a sample, either a clinical sample or a environmental sample, and put it on a cell line, which is that's been retrieved from an animal or a human, and grow the virus. And so that was first done in the 1940s. So that really made things a lot easier.
So that was quite a big innovation.
It was huge. And it was only later in the 1980s that PCR, that everybody's heard about nowadays, that was developed. And so that made things a lot easier. You didn't even have to grow the virus. You can just look for it in a molecular way.
Yeah.
So poliovirus was the first virus that was used for wastewater surveillance, and that's been used as part of the global eradication program for polio. So when COVID arrived, there was some experienced environmental virology people that knew about polio. They'd also done some work on other pathogens like measles.
Yeah.
To demonstrate that you could actually use it to see what's going on in the community.
Yeah.
We didn't know whether it was going to work. and so there was a laboratory in the Netherlands that first tried it, showed it worked, and it soon caught on. And
everyone else realised, and then, yeah.
Other people used it. Mm. Yeah.
Okay. Just because I heard of it for the first time in 2019 does not mean that it's the first time any other people had heard of it. Yeah.
That's right.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think people, or maybe myself, will have a general understanding of the idea of wastewater testing, right? It's we release waste through to the sewage system, and then that wastewater can then be tested for a whole number of diseases and other things that is in the wastewater. But taking it a step back, could you explain how a disease which may live in our nose, throat, chest area, that's generally where I felt COVID the most when I had it, ends up in our waste? How does that actually happen?
Yeah, well, the virus that causes COVID, SARS-CoV-2, it's passed through a respiratory transmission route, so you're exactly right. That's how it goes in the body. But it's also shed in feces. So the virus itself isn't infectious in poo,
yeah.
But it's detectable in poo.
So we're safe in the lab.
For that particular
yes.
sample,
great.
There's a lot of other viruses like poliovirus.
That isn't the same.
Norovirus, those yeah. sorts of, we call them enteric viruses that actually grow outside. They're not respiratory viruses, they're called enteric viruses, and they multiply in the digestive system. And so they're shed in poo and they're infectious. In poo, and that's how they're transmitted. So they're transmitted by what we call a fecal oral route. So sounds ghastly, but it's basically ingesting fecal material or vomitus.
Yeah, okay.
But SARS-CoV-2 is not transmitted in that way. Yeah. It's transmitted by respiratory, but it doesn't mean it doesn't get shed in feces. So they shed through the body. Other viruses also do that, like influenza.
Okay.
And RSV, the respiratory viruses, they can also be shed in feces.
Yeah.
As can lots of other pathogens that are not enteric in nature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So off camera, I can see some samples of something. Don't know what's in these bottles necessarily, but I wanted to kind of take it back to understand. So we shed through our wastewater, then there's wastewater plants, and my terminology will probably be incorrect in this sense, but how does the process kind of work? How do you go from there to get it to the lab? Can we talk through that process of how this kind of, the wastewater testing, how it kind of all comes about?
The samples that we received are from wastewater treatment plants. So that's taking in wastewater from individual properties within what we call the catchment.
Okay, so an area that you're looking at, per se?
Yeah. So not everybody's connected to a wastewater treatment plant.
Mm.
So in New Zealand, it's about 70% of people are connected to the wastewater treatment plant. There's some people that are not, they're on septic tanks, so they're not connected. But the vast majority of people are on a wastewater treatment system where their wastewater, when you flush the toilet, goes down a pipe.
Yeah.
And it goes to the wastewater treatment plant. So you can imagine there's millions and millions and millions of litres of wastewater.
Yeah.
Mostly it's water that's been flushed with the toilet. So a lot of it isn't solid material, and it's also paper.
Yeah. Oh, toilet paper.
Toilet
yes.
paper,
okay.
et cetera. So the vast majority is water, which is why it's called wastewater.
Yeah.
So we have to get a representative sample.
I was going to say.
So there's two sorts of samples that we could get. One's called a grab, and literally it's just grabbing a sample
so
as it's passing up in a pipe.
Going into the pipe and then
it's at a certain place in the pipe that you can just grab a sample.
Form of system much.
Well, the best way is to look over 24 hours and every 24 hours take a subsample.
Yeah.
And then combine them.
Yeah.
Luckily, there's machines that do that called an auto sampler.
Yeah.
So every so many minutes, it takes a little bit of a sample 20 minutes later, takes another sample, and then combines that into one sample.
Okay, got you.
And from that big sample, we take a litre.
Cool.
Yeah, so obviously ESR are not the ones that take the samples.
Yes, that was, yeah.
They're taken by the operators of the wastewater treatment plant, and without those help, we wouldn't have this shit to play with, shit to test, should say. We're totally reliant, and over the period of this wastewater surveillance, they've all been great, and we receive samples from most treatment plants that we're including twice a week, and you can see behind you the chili bins that they arrive in, which are shipped most days of the week around the country for the operators, including the councils and the other wastewater treatment operators who were fully reliant on to do that.
I definitely want to talk about the web and network of different organizations, different people that are involved, because I mean, at the start of the pandemic, it was all just, hey, who can help, who can do this, who can do that. So I imagine there were some very stressful moments for a lot of people, but coming together is probably what led to the success of the entire system there.
Yeah. When Delta arrived in New Zealand, we thought it was just in Auckland.
Yeah.
We had to make sure that it was only in Auckland so that measures could be put in place to contain it. Because at that time, the vaccinations hadn't been fully
rolled out.
We were mid through our rollout of vaccinations. So it was important to have a good good information on how far it had spread. So we put the call out to basically everybody that we knew, all the wastewater treatment operators, whatever they'd got, they needed to send to us. And that response was awesome. We were getting 200 plus samples a week from the top of the North Island to the south of the South Island, which showed that it hadn't spread and it was just in Auckland.
Yeah.
And that information was so valuable.
Oh, 100%.
Following that, we monitored very carefully any community spread across New Zealand, which for everybody in the lab, pretty stressful. That's a pretty stressful time.
Pretty stressful time for a lot of different people. And I remember jumping to watch TV every single day, 1 p.m. to get the announcements. So, would have been different, you know, you finding out maybe a bit earlier to then us finding out later on. It would have been different levels of stress and just emotions that were going through.
Yeah. But I think at that time, it was there was a few examples. One of them was in Stratford where we had a positive detection in wastewater. There was no cases being reported.
Mm.
And it was 10 days later where cases were identified. People didn't go about doing stuff normally. They knew that there was some COVID in the community. Yeah. They changed their behaviours.
Their habits.
Race meeting was cancelled. People were more careful.
So I know that within the actual wastewater testing kind of process, there's this concentration process, right? And that kind of happens, and work with me with my NCA level 3 understanding of science. So that happens with a centrifuge, which Siri told me on the way here, spins things around at quite a high speed to try separate different items. Then there's also PEG solution. I'm kind of getting there, but could you tell me about how that process actually works out there?
So concentrations of viruses are relatively low in wastewater.
Yeah.
Much lower than they would be in a clinical sample generally. So, and also there's components there that we don't want to include in our testing. So what we have to do, we basically have to get rid of all the water.
Okay, because it's mostly water.
Because it's mostly water.
That we've just like flushed down from the toilet.
Yeah, so we want to get rid of all of that. Yeah. So there's different ways of doing that and concentrating the viruses that we're interested in. So the way that we do it at ESR, you're right. We do some centrifugation and we do some... We add a reagent called PEG. And that's basically two processes that will help to remove the water and concentrate a litre down to a teaspoon.
Oh, wow. So within that process, you try remove the water, remove the additional things that are in the kind of the wastewater sample you have,
yes,
to try and get the virus, if it's there, concentrated down to the teaspoon size?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. The wastewater has two components. It's the solids, which is basically any...
It's any poo?
Any,
right? Anything
any
else
poo,
as well?
Toilet paper...
Anything else people flush down?
Anything else, yeah. But yeah. I mean, this is post-screening, so there's not huge pieces. It's smaller pieces. So it can be centrifuged down. But we also want the solid material because viruses bind to the solid material.
Oh, okay.
So we
got
want
you.
To be able to get viruses out of the liquid and also from the solid. So we have a few steps that allow us to concentrate from both of those fractions, both from the liquid and the solid.
Yeah.
So some labs will send it through a filter, which is another way.
Okay, cool.
Some labs just take the solid and just use the solid and don't bother with the liquid. But we've developed this protocol that's pretty standard. It's been around for decades.
Yeah.
It works well, and it works well for lots of different viruses.
Okay, cool. So... how do we then get this teaspoon-sized solution? How do we then go from that to then actually determining whether it actually contains the virus or not? Because will that also contain maybe a tiny bit of water and other, I'm going to say random things. This is because I don't understand what the science is, but will that contain other things as well as the disease?
Yeah, it contains lots of things, including bacteria and bits of solid materials. The virus is the smallest component of what's in there.
I see. Okay.
So what we have to do then, we have to take a small amount. We call it an aliquot.
An aliquot?
An aliquot.
Is that like a measurement?
Yeah, it's a small subsample.
Okay.
I was always under the impression that the word aliquot, everybody knows what that word means.
No, I can't say I've ever heard that before in my life.
No?
Maybe it's just me. Can we get a... have you... no. We're getting some nose. No. Okay, I'm feeling very vindicated.
Aliquot is a term that's used a lot in science.
Okay, cool.
I always thought it was something that everybody knew.
Okay, so we
so
have
we take an aliquot, which means a subsample of a bigger sample.
Yeah.
And we break down the virus, and what we're interested in is a nucleic acid from the virus.
Okay.
So we do what we call it's a purification to remove everything that we don't want and just try to keep the viral nucleic acid. Mm. And from that, and that's the same procedure for COVID testing, by PCR testing, we'll do a PCR to measure how much nucleic acid we've got.
Yeah.
And so each bit of nucleic acid equals one virus.
Okay.
And so we can measure how many, we call it genome copies.
Because genome sequencing, another term that people probably now know they'd never heard of before.
That's right, yeah. So...
just saying my buzzwords that I
know. And yes, so we use PCR to quantify how much virus we've got in the sample.
Yeah.
And from that, we can calculate how many virus copies we've got in a litre.
Oh, okay.
And then from that, knowing how much water has flowed through the wastewater treatment plant, as well as how many people are contributing to that, we can work out a metric, and it's called genome copies per person per day.
Okay.
And that is then graphed and used on our dashboard and tracked over time.
So that process at the end there, you can kind of get a calculation of, is it how many people within the catchment area will have COVID?
No.
Okay, what does that tell
you? No. The wastewater surveillance doesn't tell you how many people are infected. You can't do that.
Yeah.
But you can have a measure of whether the trend's going up or going down.
I see, yeah.
So you might have 6 million genome copies per person per day being shed.
Yeah.
Next week it might be 8 million genome copies per person
per day. People. Okay, gotcha.
So it's a measure of how much is in the community.
Yeah.
So right now, we're seeing elevated levels compared to the last few months.
I see.
It's not as high as it was in the first wave,
yeah.
and indeed in the second in wave we've got. So this has been described as the fifth wave. the levels are higher, so we can monitor that.
Yeah.
And we can compare that to the number of cases.
Okay.
So right now, there's a difference between how many cases being reported and the wastewater.
I see.
So cases might be going up a little bit, or the wastewater might be going up
quite
higher.
Quite aggressively, yeah.
So the wastewater surveillance doesn't rely on people going to the doctors.
Yeah.
It doesn't rely on people reporting their RAT tests.
Yeah.
People don't have to do anything at all.
See, they use the bathroom.
We're using it in catchments that have got quite a large population, more than 10,000 people.
Yeah.
So it can't be, it's anonymous.
Can't be individually traced back.
You can't be traced back to an individual person.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Now let's head back to, say, December 2019, January, February 2020. So I, completely outside of this world, I'm hearing that there is a virus that is somewhat similar to the flu that might be coming around, but it's also super spreader. What are those early moments like for you within ESR and then also you personally, noting that the first case arrived in New Zealand that I guess we know of February 28th, 2020. What were those early moments like for you?
Well, if we can backtrack to December 2019, I remember reading about this virus in China.
Yeah.
And I remember another virologist saying to me, oh, have you heard about that? I says, yeah. And I remember saying to her, and I remember where I was. Sometimes you just remember these things. I remember saying, it'd be nothing. So.
Hey, I said that countless times.
Very quickly, when we came back after the Christmas break, we were on alert and we knew something was happening.
Yeah.
But we didn't know what was going to happen. And for the first case, and we didn't know we could use wastewater at that time either. Mm. It was something that we were thinking about doing. We didn't know whether it was going to work. At that time, it already, this was thinking about February.
Yeah.
It was already in Europe in high numbers. But by March, April, we were starting to think that we could use wastewater as a surveillance tool.
Yeah.
And we did some preliminary testing because we'd got some small outbreaks. I don't know if you remember the Matamata outbreak.
Yeah.
The wedding.
Yeah.
So we managed to get some wastewater samples from a few sites where we knew there were cases and applied a method that we'd already used already. Surprisingly, we picked it up.
Mm.
That was a good day.
Good.
I thought, it does work. And we did need to amend a few little processes. So we were in a good position in New Zealand because over those 6 weeks where everybody else was in lockdown, the scientists and technicians at ESR were still coming in, making sure we could we would be ready for testing of not only wastewater but COVID samples as well. We were very busy. Roads were really quiet, so it was really easy to get to work. After it was eradicated, we didn't have anything to use. All the samples would have been negative.
True, because if we didn't have any COVID in the community, we couldn't actually do any of the...
But what we did have and what a lot of countries didn't understand was the sensitivity. And so we utilised the fact that we've got all our positive cases in one building, more or less.
Jet Park, infamous Jet Park. Yeah,
we worked on getting a sampler set up.
Yeah,
In the premises of the hotel.
Yeah,
And also at the wastewater treatment plant at a point just before it gets to the treatment plant called the interceptor.
Yeah.
Now, before I started all this, I didn't know what an interceptor was, and. It's just a place where all the pipes are coming together from a certain area of a catchment.
Yeah.
So in Auckland, there is a number of interceptors.
Yeah.
So that you can say, rather than using the wastewater treatment plant, which is over 1 million people, it splits up the catchments into smaller areas.
Okay.
So the Jet Park was on a particular interceptor. So we were testing the interceptor and Jet Park every single day for 4 months. And because we knew exactly how many people we had, yeah. we could calculate the sensitivity.
Oh, okay, great.
So we calculated the sensitivity to be 10 people per 100,000, and that would almost guarantee that we would pick it up.
Oh, okay. So in other places around the world, they could not calculate that sensitivity.
No, because it was everywhere.
It was everywhere.
It was everywhere. They just knew it worked.
Everything everywhere all at the same time, yeah.
They just knew it worked. So it was a low prevalence setting.
Yeah.
And that made that possible.
Okay.
So that was cool, and it gave us a lot of information about how we could use it. Mm. And that work was funded by MB.
Yeah.
So that was invaluable. And also they funded to do a trial later on in that year, sites around New Zealand. And that was used to make sure that we had the logistics set up and show proof of concept that we could actually do it.
Could do it and
week
roll
in,
it
week
out.
Out.
Yeah.
To make the results available to the Ministry of Health. And
to have the reporting element of that, daily press conferences, questions. Yeah.
So during that year, we made the most of the time to get a system up and running that could be used for a longer term surveillance program using wastewater.
Great. So to begin with, you would have verified that the science works. Great. Okay, we can test for COVID-19 through the wastewater. To then rolling it out nationally, there would have been a lot of stressful moments, a lot of anxious phone calls, but a lot of different agencies, people, organisations involved. Could you take me through how you went from day one to it just happening now and people don't even think about it and realise it?
Yeah. So I suppose the work started off as a research project.
Yeah.
And then, moving that from a research project, move it to a longer-term surveillance program needs the support of somebody like the Ministry of Health.
Yeah.
It was the Ministry of Health that supported
the
idea that wastewater surveillance could help them in their public health response
during
the COVID pandemic. So it wasn't as easy as, like, can you just do it? We had to get the support of the wastewater treatment plant operators. And it was clear at the beginning that they could do it, and they were on board, and everybody was just awesome at supporting the program because they were doing it in their own time. And some of the plants that we needed to test were in areas where we call them unmanned wastewater treatment plants.
Yeah.
Nobody actually works there all the time.
Yeah.
And so some collectors were basically spending most of their day going from plant to plant collecting the samples.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Really time consuming.
Yeah.
So without that we couldn't have done it. But it was more of a question of how much could be collected, how much the laboratory could do, making sure the samples were collected in good time, getting them delivered to ESR the next day after collection. The logistics around how many samples we could do, training up new staff.
Yeah.
Because at the time when we first started, we had 3 people.
Yeah.
and so now we've got a team of 10 people working on other things as well. But a lot of them were taken on just for the surveillance. But also how the results could be shared.
Yeah.
And it was important not only to share them with the Ministry of Health, who were going to use the results, but also sharing with the public. And some of that was through the TV.
Yeah.
But after that, we needed to share them in different ways. And the most logical one is a dashboard that's available for everybody to look at. And that's that got developed and was launched in 2022.
Yeah.
So that's been available for people to see.
Yeah.
And
cool. So you mentioned the sharing of all of that information and just how, in general, the average level of understanding of all these terms has increased tenfold. What does the epidemiology network kind of look like now? Are there people on the internet who are doing this work with all this new knowledge? What does that world look like?
Yeah. When COVID surveillance by wastewater first started, it was just presence, absence. Is it there or is it not?
Yeah.
And that was really important for New Zealand for ages because we weren't bothered about how much there was. There was no trend. It was either a one-off, it was either a positive
or
a negative.
Not, yeah.
Then it developed into the quantitation. So it was how much there was there and whether that correlated with the number of cases. And it did. It correlates with the number of cases. But more recently, for New Zealand, it's been what variants are available.
Of course.
What variants are circulating in the community.
Yeah.
So that's been something that we've been doing now for almost 2 years. And so at the beginning, regular virologists would look at the data. But as the data increased from cases, the amount of data is just...
insurmountable?
Yeah, across the globe.
Yeah.
And so countries are very good at looking about what's happening for their...
Within a country.
What's been lacking is really looking at the picture on a global scale.
Yeah.
So a lot of people had a lot of spare time on their hands during lockdowns.
At home, able to work.
And some people who are not trained virologists,
yeah,
who are really interested in patterns,
yeah,
or numbers or massive sources of data, have got interested in looking at variants that are available to everybody on a public available database.
Yeah.
And these are people who are administrators or data science people or teachers who have now become expert COVID sleuths.
Because the data's just out there, yeah.
And actually, they're the people now that are spotting new variants.
Yeah.
Not trained virologists or not trained bioinformatics. And they're not being paid for what they're doing, or they've become valuable in looking out for new variants. And on several occasions, they've been the ones that have detected new variants that have come to become problematic globally.
So just so I understand, there are these people on the internet, and obviously they exist in real life, who are analysing this data that's also online, who aren't necessarily working with any institutions. As you said, they could be a teacher by trade, they could be a videographer by trade, but they are assisting in some detection of variants and how COVID is moving around the world and maybe other diseases?
So they're most interested in COVID.
Yeah.
And it started where they were just interested in looking at the sequence data, looking for patterns, looking for mutations that hadn't been seen before, recognising that, that was detected in, for example, Israel, and also that was detected in Denmark, which was an example of the newest ones that we had a bit of a concern about, called BA286.
Yeah.
It was recognised by one of these COVID sleuths that this virus has actually been recognised in two separate countries, which alerted everybody else to go, actually, we should start looking for this, including New Zealand. And for that particular virus that I'm talking about there, that we were alerted from...
A Twitter user.
We actually looked in wastewater, and after a couple of weeks of looking, we found it in wastewater first, and it was a few weeks later we detected it in a clinical sample.
I see. Wow. So they're really part of the fight against COVID-19.
Yeah. It's important to know what we're dealing with. If you don't know what we're dealing with...
don't know what to test for.
And these can predict possibly trends going forward and gives really, really valuable information.
Cool.
And I think without those, I think we would be worse off.
So to end, I've got a couple questions which I might try wheel into one. What does the future for the wastewater technology within New Zealand and the world? How is it being applied elsewhere? And I know we were talking off camera about how you recently went on a trip overseas, and the kind of the purpose was to look at how wastewater is also going to be used internationally in future pandemics in preparation. What does the general future hold for wastewater testing?
Yeah. So far, wastewater surveillance has been... mainly initiated by independent, universities,
institutions.
On either regional, occasionally national scale. A lot of them have been project based, so short term projects. Funding's been uncertain, and also the future has been uncertain.
And always is.
And also because it's a new sort of surveillance tool, there has been some challenges to convince everybody that this actually is useful. There's still some work to do to show some what we call use cases. How useful it's been for surveillance purposes. So right now we're trying to move away from short-term projects to more of a longer-term surveillance. And the European Commission, European Union, the WHO, supported by Gates Foundation, for example, are really in support of setting up a global wastewater surveillance network, supporting development for low and middle income countries to set up wastewater based epidemiology, which is really important for some countries in Africa, for example, where some communities are really reluctant to go and seek medical care. Wastewater surveillance is going to be really valuable. And we heard in Frankfurt at the meeting the true value of wastewater surveillance in those sorts of communities to inform on infections and trends in regions that maybe healthcare isn't optimal. So it's not only something that high-income countries like New Zealand, the States, Europe can use, but the idea that it can be used, you know, on a global, but also to link up results on a global scale, to help inform maybe in our future pandemic. One of the problems with COVID, we didn't have a really good understanding about how it was spreading. If we've already got a network set up, and that can include airport sampling, where you're not so concerned about infections coming into a particular country, but how a virus or other pathogen is being distributed globally. So it was a 2-day meeting in Frankfurt. And the meeting was attended by lots of different people from all over the world. All with the
distinct goal of
continuing with wastewater surveillance and pushing it out beyond COVID. And we can see that already. There's some research projects to look at the usefulness on other pathogens, such as flu, and other respiratory and enteric pathogens, where wastewater could be useful. And of course, poliovirus surveillance, where wastewater was originally used, has been really important in the global eradication program. And there's been some recent detections in wastewater that have prompted vaccination campaigns, for
public
example,
in the
UK, for example. And in New Zealand, we've recommenced poliovirus surveillance, mainly to demonstrate that we still are polio-free. So it's not always in the pursuit of trying to detect. It's trying to say, it's also used
prevention.
To show that it's not here.
Cool. So what are the other applications of the technology? How is it being used elsewhere?
So as well as infectious diseases, drugs in wastewater is also a thing. It's mainly for illicit drug usage. And this isn't to spy on anybody. This is to be used for where resources may be put, education programs put. If you can see there's increased use of a particular illicit drug in a particular region, it's to aim resources. It can also be used for things like pharmaceuticals and also, you know, well-being of people. Different analytes can be tested for. As long as there's social license, i.e. that people are on board with this, if people aren't on board with it and there is no social license, there is no future.
Yeah.
So it's important that we listen to communities.
Yeah.
We listen to what's acceptable, what's not acceptable.
Yeah.
And yeah, science has to work like that now. It's not.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's not got just to work what with we. The... It's not just what the scientists want. It's exactly. This is for communities. It's for public health as
so
well.
So got to get a good understanding of what they want and what they need and what they're comfortable with as well.
That's right. Yeah. So. Yeah, we still have work to do on a global scale on understanding acceptability of testing people's waste.
Yeah.
But we've come a long way in the last few years and we've learned a lot of lessons that we can take forward.
Cool. I just want to thank you for coming on to PhD Unpacked and talking about this. I think COVID has impacted every single person's life in various different ways, and understanding how we were able to prevent a lot of deaths will be exciting to a lot of people. So I want to thank you, I want to thank ESR as well, I want to thank MB for being a part of this, and we hope that the listeners at home have enjoyed this, and let us know if you have any further questions. We can try and get a better understanding of everything. Thank you very much for coming on to the show. Cheers.
Thank you for visiting.
Thank you.